Okay. Singularities are in fact quite generic in general relativity. In fact, starting with some smooth initial conditions, it's generically they can arise. And in particular, singularities which are space-like are particularly puzzling from the point of view of physics. That's because these are not singularities which you can point out and say it's there, because it's not there, it's going to happen at some future time, or it already happened at that past time. And it's something which you cannot avoid, and which there's a certain level of inevitability to it. And if they're really there, it does signify either the end of time or the beginning of time, and then things get very murky. So a lot of physicists wouldn't like to have that, would like to have a situation where there's something else in the region where we were thinking of singularities. And the clue comes from the fact, this rather wonderful property of singularities, that typically the very equations which lead you to believe that there would be a singularity break down precisely in those regions. Some curvature invariants blow up, tidal gravitational forces blow up, so something happens. So it's a bit of a strange thing that you started solving some equations, like Einstein equations, arrived at the conclusion that something goes singular, and by singular I do not necessarily mean something which has an infinite tidal force, anything which has a curvature which is large enough, large compared to the Planck scale or the string scale, is good enough. But precisely at that region, the equations which you started out solving don't make any sense. So there ought to be something else. So the real question here, what is this something else which we are going to use to understand this region which we call singular? So what I'll do in this talk is to give you a kind of an impressionist view without any equations, but maybe with very little equations and very little technical detail, some of the basic ideas which are pursued by some workers in the field, including myself and some others, which I'll name in due course. And this approach is based upon a particular realization of a very old idea in the field, namely an idea which is, when first stated, appears to be pretty vague, which says that space-time is an approximate concept. This doesn't make much sense unless you tell it is an approximation of what. And this approach, which is the ADS-CFT correspondence, as popularly known, it's written out here, is something which realizes this kind of dream, if you wish, of having a framework where you go to a certain approximation, you recover the conventional notions of space and time, but the framework is a lot more general. And so therefore, you have the hope of using this framework to understand regions which are puzzling from the point of view of ordinary space-time. The simplest, I will not go into the origins of this kind of correspondence, which actually comes from string theory. But I suspect the idea is much more general than particular realizations of string theory. And the simplest setting is, the simplest formulation, as due to Maldacena, is a statement which I'll try to explain as I go along, is that a certain theory with an unimaginative name, like type 2B string theory, is my writing large enough? Okay. On a certain space-time, which I'll call ADS 5 cross S 5, this is a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, a solution of Einstein equations in five dimensions with a negative cosmological constant. And S 5 is a five-dimensional sphere. I'll call the radius of the sphere R, and the length scale which controls the curvatures of the five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space is also R in this particular case, has an equivalent description in terms of a non-gravitational theory, which has again this name, I should call n equal to 4 super Young-Mills theory. It's a cousin of standard Young-Mills theory with lots and lots of other fields in it and lots of symmetries in it. But the point of the fact of the matter is it's a normal quantum field theory with a non-fluctuating metric, something which lives on some fixed background. And therefore, you might think that you probably understand the theory a little bit better than theories with a fluctuating metric. Not necessarily true, as we will see, but nevertheless. And this theory lives on the boundary of ADS. So ADS spacetime sort of roughly looks like this. This is ADS 5. There is a time which is running upward. You can take a cross-section at a given time. It has two sets of coordinates, something r, which is a radial coordinate. And this you think of making three angles of a three-dimensional sphere. So the boundary of this space-time, so this is a boundary. It is characterized by a time and three angles, theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, which make up a three-dimensional sphere. That's all we need to know. Since in a certain regime, and it's only in a certain regime, this theory, the type 2B string theory, which is a theory of closed strings which are splitting and joining in this particular background, for a certain energy regime, it contains what we know as gravity and the equations. In the field theory. I will write down some equations which will make it very clear. Okay. Just in a few minutes. It contains gravity, and the equations contain cousins of Einstein equations. These are actually supergravity equations of motion, because there are again a whole lot of other fields which are sort of essential in the main point. This is sometimes called a gauge gravity duality. What I would like to emphasize, however, it is a lot more general than that, because as we will see in a moment, this theory is recognizable as normal gravity in normal space-time only in a very particular limit. And this would be one of the main points of this talk. So let's look at what is the limit. So as you asked, there is a length scale r, which is sitting here. String theory has a dimensionless parameter, which is called the string coupling, GS. It also has a basic length scale, which provides the units for everything in string theory, which is a length scale I'll call RS. So that given this background r, there are therefore two dimensionless quantities, GS and R by LS. This gauge theory has a gauge group, which is SUN. This is the rank of the group. And it, of course, has a Young-Mills coupling constant. This is, of course, a very special theory, because the coupling constant is really a coupling constant. It's really a dimensionless number, which you can call large and small, unlike normal QCD, where the coupling constant is sort of fake, where it gets transmuted into a mass scale. So this is another dimensionless quantity. So in order to state the correspondence, I got to tell you how these things are related. And this, in fact, is the key point. There are a couple of things which you notice from this. The first thing is that the natural way, and in fact, to this date, probably the only limit in which we can think in a reasonable fashion about this duality, is in Stokes' large n limit. Where this rank of the gauge group is taken to be very, very large. With the coupling constant, lambda is g square n, is held fixed. The motivation for this kind of limit, I'll not go into the historical reasons why this limit was invented, but the motivation, if you just look at even the Feynman diagrams of this gauge theory, you will very easily see, for example, things organize as, you know, the vertices organize as powers of g young mil square n rather than g young mil square, basically because there are n square colors in the theory. So this immediately tells you something, the first important point, namely, the quantum fluctuations of the bulk, I will call the whatever theory that is living here in the interior, this type 2B string theory, as the bulk. These quantum fluctuations of the bulk are controlled by the coupling constant of that, which is Gs. And in that limit, that is 1 upon n, because Gs is G young mil square, and G young mil square is lambda upon n, and lambda is held fixed. So when n is large, we can forget about quantum effects in the string theory. We have a classical string theory. This also tells you that when lambda is large, then the length scale, which is present in this background, and which therefore controls the curvature, the mean curvature at points in this background, is in fact very large. If the curvatures are very weak, it's hard to excite other modes of the string, and the theory basically reduces down to supergravity. So this is the regime where we have normal spacetime as we know it, and supergravity. So the whole idea is, of course, in this entire game, is that it is in this sense that in this extremely special situation, you have a parent theory, which is some Young-Mills theory living on the boundary. And there is a certain limit of that parent theory where it appears that there is an alternative description of the physics of that parent theory in terms of gravitational degrees of freedom. Okay. In other regimes, of course, a theory presumably makes sense. But even when n is large, you got to have some idea what is this string theory on ADS5 cross S5. Now, even though we write this thing, we know very little about the string theory in ADS5 cross S5. Yeah. No, I mean, because if you're basically this issue has got to do with taking the flat space limit of this correspondence. And it turns out there have been many, many attempts to do that. I'm not completely educated about why they fail, but the fact is that they all are very troublesome. So basically, this so far has been extremely good in regimes where supergravity is valid, and so therefore at length scales which are comparable to or bigger than the RADS scales. For example, we don't have a very good description as yet of black holes, which are much smaller than the size of RADS. We have a good description of black holes, which are bigger than the size of RADS. Because if we did know this physics at distances much smaller than RADS, it's as good as knowing physics in flat space time, which we don't. OK. So the idea is that can we use the fact, nevertheless? So if you knew what string theory in ADS 5 process 5, you would have said, OK, fantastic. Well, as people who were still around, who were there in the 1980s, string theory is supposed to solve everything in the world. So you know the string theory, you know everything. Okay. But of course, there is no string theory here. And so we wonder whether you can actually address this issue by looking at the gauge theory. Now, it turns out that the most useful applications of the ADS-CFT correspondence are actually the other way around. Namely, it's using this site, and by this site, mostly in the regime where this is valid, to understand something about the dynamics of this kind of theory. And I've just given you an example of this correspondence in the simplest setting. And of course, there is a huge number of such correspondences, and extremely interesting things have come out in areas as diverse as hydrodynamics, as diverse as some aspects of condensed matter physics, possibly, and many others. What we'll try to do try to use it the other way around, namely try to see if we can gain any insight into the troublesome regions of this side by reformulating the question as a question in gauge theory. To do that, I have to give you some basic properties, a basic aspect of this correspondence. Just telling you that something is equivalent to something else doesn't mean very much. So I got to tell you a little bit more. Of course, if this correspondence was valid only if the interior was strictly ADS 5 cross S 5 and the theory was strictly n equal to 4 Young-Mills theory, it would be a bit boring. The reason why it is interesting is because you can go away from that kind of description. And the way to go away is to use gauge invariant operators of the gauge theory. There are, of course, infinite number of them. I'll just generically write them as OI. Typical examples are, for example, trace F square, or the energy momentum tensor of the gauge theory, or hundreds of other things which you can, infinite number of other things which you can write down. The idea is that each such gauge invariant operator is dual to what I'll call a field with a quotation mark in the bulk, and we'll soon see why I'll call it a field in quotation marks rather than just as fields. Now, given such any set of operators in the theory, you can do a couple of things with it. So I'll name two interesting things which you can do with it. The first interesting thing which you can do with it is to keep the Young-Mills theory as it is. So the Hamiltonian is as it is. And you take this operator, act it on the vacuum, and you get an excited state. This is a state of the gauge theory. And this correspondence is correct. This should be also be a state of this string theory in the bulk. So this is a state. The second thing which you can do if you have an operator at hand is to deform the Hamiltonian, or let me write the action of the theory, by a term with some coupling times C operator, to emphasize the fact these are actually functions of space and time. So this is a different theory from what he started out with. This is not the n equal to 4 Young-Mills theory. By deforming the theory, you can do all kinds of things to it, break supersymmetry, in which we'll have, in fact, time-dependent deformations, we take time translation invariance. And you've got to ask, what does this correspond to in the bulk description? It turns out what this corresponds to are what I'll call sources. Well, it's of course a source in the Young-Mills action, but I'll specify what you mean by sources. These notions of, you know, having a field, a source, and a state becomes rather transparent in the limit where the R upon LS is large. And the reason is that in that limit, you can think of the theory of the bulk as roughly like a field theory. So it's really a local field theory with some number of fields. There's still some nice space-time. So in that limit, you can understand what these things are in the bulk. What this thing is in the bulk is, in fact, of course, you are, by doing something with these operators, you are going away from ADS5 cross S5. So that was your intention to begin with. This corresponds to a normalizable deformation. And if you think about it for a little bit, you can see that why this should be so. After all, you're trying to describe some state, which is two descriptions, something in terms of the gauge theory, something in terms of the bulk. And if it is any reasonable state in any reasonable framework, it better be something which is sort of localized in the bulk, something which doesn't spread all the way to the boundary. So in fact, in the supergravity approximation, what this amounts to, you take the standard equations of supergravity, the Einstein equations and the generalizations, and make a small deformation of the various fields in the theory. You end up solving a second order differential equation, typically has two kinds of solutions. This is a space with a boundary. There will be a solution which is normalizable, which typically could lead to some conditions on the mode numbers which appear in that solution. The second one corresponds to a non-normalizable deformation. That also is quite intuitive. What's really happening for a non-normalizable deformation in terms of the original picture of ADS is that you sort of have a wave which has a non-zero amplitude even on that boundary. So it sort of can, you can sort of think of that you have lighted a little source on that boundary, and that source is causing a deformation of the solution in the bulk. Okay? So that's, in fact, the way to think about it. The way you think about this deformed actions is to think of, you know, having a little source which couples to one of the fields in the interior, and so by a retarded action, it sort of lights up the interior of the bulk, and therefore, and by its various back reaction, exciting the other modes of the theory, deforming the solution. How are we going to do this to understand cosmological backgrounds? I think this is more or less the background which I need. So let me now proceed to several ways of using this basic fact to try to understand cosmological background and the limited set of results which people have obtained in this field. I'll try to describe, out of the many approaches, three approaches. The first one is something which I have been associated with, the paper which is closest to the spirit of what I'll be talking about now, is which is something which is co-authored with several other people. Awad. We all live on various continents. And of course, I'll not describe that paper. That's not the intention. But the general idea, which is there in this paper and in several earlier papers all along the same field. So the idea is as follows. It's usually crucially use the fact that you can deform the theory in the boundary as well as in the bulk by turning on a source on the gauge theory. What I'll do is to use a very simple kind of source in the gauge theory, which amounts to saying, make the coupling constant and whenever I say coupling constant, I always mean the Etoft constant, a function of time. Well, nothing wrong with that. You have a Young-Mills theory, it has a coupling. Stick in some your desired function of time in there. It's a Hamiltonian which is time dependent, nothing wrong with that either. That's what you want. Still satisfies Schrodinger equation. And if you can do it with some given initial conditions, find out the wave function at a given at a later time. So that, of course, is completely standard, maybe be difficult to consider. What does this correspond to in the bulk? In the bulk, I said that for every operator in the gauge theory, there is a corresponding field. And I put quotation marks in the field. The reason I put quotation marks in the field is that this correspondent, the thing that it corresponds to, is morally speaking only a field in the supergravity regime. In the string theory regime, you just throw up your hands. And you don't know what, because it's a strong non-locality in the space. You don't know whether it's useful even to think of the higher stringy modes as really fields in a theory. But sometimes you can think of it as an infinite set of fields. But really speaking, that's not what it is. The corresponding field to the coupling constant, so the coupling constant sits in front of the operator, which is trace F square. The corresponding field is one of the many, many fields in supergravity, which is a dilaton. So what this corresponds to, so have a dilaton with, it's a non-normalizable mode of the dilaton. It has a certain boundary value with a boundary value. Which I'll call phi naught of t, such that e to the phi naught of t is in fact lambda of t by n. Because the left-hand side is what we call the string coupling constant. The right-hand side is the Young-Mills coupling constant. OK? Now imagine that I choose lambda of t to be of this following form. It starts off with a huge value and roughly constant at early times. And then it dips down to some small value and rises up again. Divide this region into three parts. One, two, and three. We're going to imagine time evolution in this direction towards positive time. And what we're going to do here is to start at very early times in the vacuum of the gauge theory. This theory, at very early times, is very strongly coupled. You put the theory in the vacuum, but it's really speaking, there's very little else you can do there, because, you know, just from the gauge theory point of view. But then ADS-CFT is wonderful, because that tells you that in the region 1, I can view the theory as the bulk theory, as supergravity. N is always taken to be much, much bigger than 1, so the bulk theory is classical. And instead of trying to solve a difficult Schrodinger equation in the gauge theory, I might as well solve the Einstein equations of motion in the bulk. So the time evolution is given by Einstein equation. That solution is conventional standard initial value condition problem with some boundary values. So what you have is some profile of this field on the boundary, which I'll sort of roughly, you know, write like that. And by retarded action in the bulk, it's going to create a deformation of the interior. Okay? As time passes, you enter the region 2. In the region 2, the coupling, the effective coupling, etrope coupling is in fact small. There is no good description, but bulk description in terms of supergravity. And the theory is in fact becoming weakly coupled. And we know that from what I just described, a weakly coupled theory on the boundary corresponds to a highly stringy bulk. And that's something, once again, we are afraid of, because we don't know what is the string thing in the bulk. There has been a lot of progress in recent years in trying to understand string theories in such background, but we don't know enough. In fact, if we forcefully extrapolate this, what will happen is, because lambda is very small, the curvatures become string scale. Morally speaking, that's what I will call some kind of singularity, namely a failure of the local equations of general relativity. So what do we do? What we'll try to do, we'll try to use the gauge theory and see what's going on. In the region 3, the coupling has again grown to very large values. So deep into the region 3, you will again regain space-time interpretation of the of this scenario. But of course, what happens in region 3 depends on what happens in region 2, just because of causality. So the question we are going to ask is that, starting with the vacuum, turning on a source on the boundary, what is the fate of the system? It passes through a region of very strong curvature in string units. And so is the system just going berserk, or it just appears to evolve in reasonably into something? And what is that something? Okay. This has been looked at in several different ways, depending on, you know, what kind of time dependence you assign to this coupling constant. I'll just briefly tell you what we have learned by looking at a very special kind of time dependence, which actually allows us to use some very special tools in the gauge theory to have some kind of conclusions. And that special thing is to have a slowly varying coupling. Slowly varying compared to what? This is a conformal field theory. So typically, there is no scale. But however, it's a conformal field theory which is living on a three-dimensional sphere. So there is a length scale. That three-dimensional length scale is, in fact, again, R. So basically, this is very small. Okay. Sometimes, I will use R equal to 1 units and refer the by some small parameter, which I'll call epsilon. Well, the coupling began big, and it is slowly varying. However, if it can vary for a long enough time, of times of the order of RADS, it can get pretty weak. Okay? And we know that whenever the coupling becomes very weak, then we have a chance to probe this very troublesome stringy region of the geometry. So we're going to evolve this for a long time. So that lambda becomes less than or equal to a power of 1. So why does it help us in understanding what's going on? Now, in the region 1, you can, as I said, you're going to solve some boundary value problem with at the initial time slice with some pure ADS cross S. So that you can do in many different regimes. In particular, you can solve the Einstein equations by treating this all the time variations to be very small. This is sort of inspired by the way one gets hydrodynamics out of quantum field theory, slowly varying quantities. And you can find out what the solution is. And I'll, of course, not write down what the solution is, but I'll just point out some key features of that solution. So in region 1, the key features are that the solution is completely smooth. There are no horizons or black holes formed during these times. You sort of expect that such a thing would hold. The reason being that, and again, there is a certain length scale in the problem which is set by RADS, and a black hole has to have some size which is RADS. You cannot form any disturbances on the boundary at energy scales which are higher than 1 upon RADS. There is a gap which is set by the size of the S3. And if things are frequencies are small enough, they will not be able to coalesce and form a black hole. In fact, there is some complementary work by Shiraj Meenwala and Bhattacharya, which examines this kind of situation in the supergravity regime in a rather complementary set of parameters. So what they consider are disturbances, namely this, what you are really doing is banging the boundary at some frequency, you know, at some rate. So what they consider are banging it very gently, that means the amplitude being small, and studying what happens at different frequencies. And in fact, what they find, if the frequency is low enough, you get a smooth solution. But if you start banging very fast, so then in fact it collapses and forms a black hole. So nothing surprising in there. In region 2, I said I have to use the gauge theory. So what does a slow variation help? You don't expect that you should be able to use something like a perturbation theory in the gauge theory to address this kind of issue. But because the theory is defined on a sphere, on S3, there is an energy gap above the ground state. This is the classic setup for an adiabatic approximation in quantum mechanics. So there should be some kind of adiabatic approximation. What the adiabatic approximation implies is a kind of an adiabatic theorem in standard quantum mechanics, which states that if the variation of parameters in a Hamiltonian is slow enough, slow compared to this gap from the ground state and the first excited state, then if I start out the system in the ground state, it's basically going to tag along. At any intermediate time, it's going to approximate the ground state of the instantaneous Hamiltonian up to exponential corrections. Okay? Now, if I could use this just as it is in this present scenario, what would happen is that you start out with the ground state. Okay, many things happen. There's a slow variation. Coupling becomes very weak. The description in the bulk becomes very complicated. But never mind that. Because of the presence of a gap, you would say, well, the ground state just followed itself. And by the time it gets up to large coupling, you regain an interpretation of that ground state as some ADS5 plus S5. In terms of the gravity, you would say you have actually managed to show that there is a bounce. There is a bounce from a very sort of a high curvature radian back into some low curvature. Unfortunately, that is, its life is not that simple. And the reason why this is not simple has got to do with trying to understand, trying to come up with something which actually matches in its appropriate regime whatever we have done in supergravity. I said that this parameter epsilon, which is del t in r equal to 1 units, is small. If you examine in detail what are the conditions of a standard type of adiabatic approximation as you open up some textbook of quantum mechanics would do, you find that you need an additional condition, which is n times epsilon equal to small for standard adiabatic. Take hold. Well, you could have a situation when n times epsilon is very small, but that is not what is required to produce the supergravity solution, which was smooth before these things started happening. You want to do something which has epsilon small, but nothing about n epsilon. Maybe even n times epsilon is very large, because n is a very large number. How do you do that? I'll not go into this thing in detail. But let me just say that in words. So we invented a kind of adiabatic approximation scheme, which is based on the following physical fact. What we wanted to do is to come up with something in the gauge theory which in its common regime of validity matches with what we had in supergravity, so we know that we're doing the right thing, and then turn to ask whether that procedure, what does happen to that procedure in the regime when lambda is small. And the key thing to realize is that I said earlier that an operator of the gauge theory acting on the vacuum has an interpretation of a state in the bulk. Now, if it is like a single operator, what it corresponds to what I'll call a single particle state in the bulk. For example, the operator we are concerned with, which is like trace F square, acting on the vacuum, creates a single dilaton state in the bulk. Square that up, it has two dilatons in the bulk. Classical solutions are not like that. Classical solutions have lots and lots of quanta in it. So, however, a classical solution in the bulk, a classical field in the bulk, has lots and lots of quanta. So they are, in fact, given in terms of coherent states, which are acting on the vacuum. So what you got to do is to have a formulation of the Schrodinger equation acting on coherent states like this, and find simplifications which can happen when this quantity is slow varying. Okay? In fact, this has a long history of considering coherent states in the subject, as has been originally recognized by the inventor of the large N expansion, Tofte. When N is very large, you get into some kind of classical limit. Now, classical limit of what? Whenever you perform a classical limit in quantum mechanics, you say, of course, that you take h bar going to 0, but you cannot just take any odd state in quantum mechanics and hope that it will just smoothly go over to a classical state. Typically, what you do is take a coherent state in quantum mechanics, and that has a smooth classical limit, in the sense that, you know, all operators factorize, expectation values of operators all factorize. So in a similar vein, because of some properties of gauge invariant operators in large N theories, properties which are called factorization, you know, if things factorize, that already starts spelling classical. So it has been investigated by a fairly large community of people in the late 70s and 80s to come up with a formalism where this kind of states are used to understand the nature of this classical limit. Unfortunately, there was very little progress. And the reason why there was very little progress is because these operators are, the algebra of these operators are very complicated. I mean, things they have, you know, non-trivial operator algebra implying three-point couplings. Yes. Good question. I think there is actually a way you can make it work for C equal to 1. Of course, C equal to 1, as you know, there is a much more direct, you know, change of variables. But as far as I remember, I think Larry Offer, who is one of the people who had been following this thing, has a way of doing it. But I got to find that out. So, where was I? So I think it's very complicated because operator algebra is very complicated. They're certainly not like coherent states in the harmonic oscillators, where this operator is something like E dagger and E dagger equal to 1, and you can just sit down and work out things. So that's what usually complicates. It turns out that in the setting where we want to use it, things simplify drastically to leading order. And the reason why things simplify is, again, because of a slowly varying field. Now, a slowly varying coupling constant on the boundary directly couples to the dilaton in the bulk. So it sets up in motion, you know, it sort of gives a little kick to the dilaton, which is right there in the boundary, and then by causality sort of spreads in the bulk. The dilaton, of course, couples to other fields, like the graviton or antisymmetric tensor, you know, who knows what. But it turns out that all those couplings, because they are basically driven by a slowly varying field, are suppressed by, again, this epsilon. So basically what is happening, you're driving the system, and it's again because the theory has a gap. You're driving a system with a frequency which is much lower than the natural frequencies of the system itself. In such a situation, the various normal modes of the system itself do not couple to each other in the lowest approximation. So to the lowest order approximation, you can consider these operators indeed as like harmonic oscillator, creation annihilation operators. You can perform a calculation by looking at the equation which follows from imposing the Schrodinger equation on such a state, and show that when lambda is large enough, the thing about there's another simplification which happens when lambda is large enough. That simplification happens because the number of such operators are now drastically cut down. They are basically the ones which are dual to the supergravity modes. The natural frequencies of all the others are much higher. Now, we don't know this directly from gauge theory. We know this because of ADS-CFT duality. So we could do a calculation, and see there's a rough approximate agreement with what you do by solving Einstein equations in this region. But now we enter this region. And if you look at the framework, you would at first think that nothing much changes. You are doing an adiabatic approximation. The couplings are still suppressed by powers of epsilon. So why not just say that the ground state just follows, tags along with the coupling, and always remains an instantaneous ground state? Well, we are a little bit hesitant to make that conclusion for the following reason. The reason is that when you get to this regime, there are lots and lots of these things, because the anomalous dimensions of these things are, they change, they depend on the coupling. At the low couplings, you would sort of expect all the stringy modes in the bulk to be very important. So if you try to, you know, write down what kind of state you should start out, it would involve, in fact, an infinite number of, a huge number of these things. Now, even though the coupling between any two of these things are small, the cumulative effect might result in the amount of energy which you have supplied into the system being dissipated. It could just go into this large number of fields and thermalize. And once, of course, things thermalize, you don't get the energy back. The energy is not extracted back. It's going to remain in the system as a kind of a thermal environment. So you will end up with this regime, if this scenario is correct, you'll end up in this regime with some, 10 minutes, okay, with some kind of thermal, some kind of thermal gas. Now, I said that there are states of the gauge theory map onto states in the bulk. A particularly interesting class of states in the gauge theory are thermal states. And indeed, thermal states map to interesting states in the bulk. They are black holes. Now, in ADS space, because of the presence of a length scale, there are several kinds of black holes. There are black holes which are of the size of the ADS scale or even larger than that. Whose radius is larger than RADS, they are called large black holes. Or radius which are smaller than RADS, they are called small black holes. Okay. You can figure out by looking at the entropies and energies of such black holes, what would be the typical energy of a large black hole in the gauge theory. They correspond to energies of order n squared multiplied by some number, which is order 1. Small black holes, because they are much smaller than the ADS scale, are morally, in fact, 10-dimensional black holes. So you can, again, work out those entropy-energy relationships. And what you find, the small black holes have energies less than order n squared. So in our formalism, even though we cannot do a very detailed calculation in this region, you know what kind of energy is being produced. And the energy which is produced, which might possibly remain, is n squared times epsilon squared. And so which is parametrically small compared to n squared. So we know that if thermalization does happen, it's going to result into small black holes and mostly ADS spacetime at the end. So it's not going to give a perfect bounce into something which is empty, but there may be small black holes which are remaining. I will end the discussion of this kind of thing. I had a big ambition of doing a lot more. So let me now talk about another approach, which is in spirit, in some senses, similar to this approach, but has a slightly different flavor to it, which stems from an original work of Hertog and Horowitz, and recently by Krapps, Hertog, and Turok. This also has the feature that you sort of invent cosmologies in the bulk by deforming the action of the Young-Mills theory by something, okay? Except it has a slightly different flavor to it. So what you do is you take the Young-Mills theory and write it as something, say, square, this is the case for ADS 5, or Young-Mills, the sum operator, I'm not writing down what that operator is, some ADS 4. And H is taken to be positive. Now, you can imagine this system as, so there's some operator here, you can imagine taking this quantum mechanical system and calculating an effective action, which is a function of O, that operator O. What this would, immediately having a positive H, would mean that the potential, effective potential of that theory would in fact be unbounded from below. Usually, you're scared of such a thing. but these authors apparently are not. They in fact want to convert this into a good thing. This is exactly what you want in cosmology. So you end up with potentials which sort of look like that. Okay. The point here is the point where, so this is like average value of O, and this is like the effective potential. This corresponds to just pure Young-Mills theory. So you start out in drawing the Young-Mills description. So you start out from there, it's like a little ball, and just set it rolling. What happens? First, I must tell you, what does it correspond to in the bulk? Well, what it corresponds to the bulk is exactly like what we had before. It must correspond to beating the boundary with something, except that we are not beating it anymore with just a time-dependent coupling constant, but a time-dependent some other source. And it couples, it so turns out, to some other field in the bulk, which is supergravity in ADS has hundreds of fields, there's no shortage of those. So it turns out that it couples to an interesting field in the bulk, which gets excited because of this banging. Okay? And pretty much like the scenario which I described before, if you just proceed to solve the Einstein equations with this kind of boundary and initial value, what you find that pretty soon, at certain time, the curvatures become very large, and you enter into a regime what I would morally call a cosmological singularity. That corresponds, in this picture, you start with this, this is ADS process 5, give a little kick to it, and out it goes. And in fact, it appears it reaches infinity in a finite time. The fact that when it reaches infinity at a finite time corresponds to hitting this region of large curvature in a finite proper time. That's what we call a singularity. Now, however, this is an unbounded potential. So what do you do with this? Well, the proposal of these authors is, and it appears that recently they have made some progress with the ADS-4, which in some cases looks a little bit better than this 5, ADS-5, is that quantum mechanically this theory actually makes sense, even though it has an unbounded potential. Now, that's not that uncommon in quantum mechanics. If you open, some relevant textbooks of quantum mechanics, you will find that there are unbounded potentials where you can actually make sense of the Schrodinger equation. Of course, you've got to put some new input to it, because after all, if I write the wave function L as a function of this quantity, something funny is happening to that wave function L, because this argument, so this is like the analog in quantum mechanics of psi of x, this argument is going to infinitely large bodies at some finite time. The further input is required to define the quantum mechanical problem, and there are many names for this kind of input. In this case, it's called a self-adjoint extension, because technically, if you try to do that, what you find is the Hamiltonian is not self-adjoint without putting more boundary conditions. So I'll not go into the technicalities, but just say that the quantum mechanics seems to make sense. Right. That's the quantum field theory, yeah. So as far as I understand from what the author says, that the situation is a lot better for ADS-4 in what they've recently done compared to their earlier things. But I'm not the author, so maybe Neil is around, you can go and bug him. Okay. But I'm just trying to tell you the spirit of this entire procedure. What it really corresponds to, we start out with a little wave function, which is sort of centered here, and it sort of rolls down and it reaches there. This, what the self-adjoint kind of extension amounts to is that the time it goes there, a little wave function starts from the other side. and sort of restores sanity in this madness, if you wish. So at the end of the day, what this thing does is it allows you to talk about time evolution across this troublesome regime in some reasonable way. And if this thing is indeed correct, there are some nice features to it, because, you know, if it comes here, if this thing goes there, you're sort of really having a bounce. And what one of the nice features of this is that what you can show is that if you take small perturbations around this wave function, they very generically to scale invariant perturbations. As is quite clear from my talk, all these attempts are very much work in progress. I mean, they are sort of groping in the darkness, but finding little pieces of light here and there. But I believe that, you know, some of the issues in doing this, I mean, this is not claimed to be a solution of the Big Bang problem of our original universe. This is claimed to be an exercise which I think we are learning, gaining experience, and learning something about why is it so difficult to address the question of cosmological singularities. And hopefully, if we know why it is so difficult, we'll eventually find some way out of it. Thank you.